Okay, I'll adjust this here. And have you been, did you follow this through the legislative process?
Pretty much.
Mm-hmm. And I assume, like a lot of other pieces of legislation, it starts out with a simple idea and gets complicated from there.
Well, this is one of those that start out complicated and got a little bit more so. No, this was never simple.
I've got a tape running.
Okay.
Judging from where it is at this point, you know, what has the reaction been from senior citizens? Is this something that people had expected when this passed?
The Medicare prescription drug benefit has received a very mixed reception. For some seniors, it has been a relatively wonderful thing because approximately a third of seniors had no drug coverage at all. And so this coverage, while many provisions are confusing and people are overwhelmed with choices, is better than nothing. And for a sizable percentage of people, that was what they had before, nothing. So it's been a big benefit. For the majority of older Americans, however, it has been a source of tremendous confusion. The biggest group of senior citizens who have drug coverage now are those who have it as a retiree health benefit through their former employer. They, in many cases, are petrified that the former employer will use the introduction of Medicare prescription drug benefits as an excuse to curtail their own benefits. Their own benefits are typically simpler, without a donut hole gap in coverage, usually a more easily understandable copay, and usually lower cost sharing generally. That group is very much concerned that this will supplant the benefits that they already have. Many major employers have been reducing retiree health benefits anyway, even in the absence of Medicare Part D. The presence of this alternative program might stimulate even more of them to do so. Still another group of seniors have Medicare prescription drug coverage through their own initiative by buying a so-called Medigap policy, specifically a Medigap policy that provided up to $1,250 of benefits, or in some cases $2,500. Those policies are rendered extinct. That is, they will no longer be obtainable after the end of 2005, and people who already have such Medigap coverage may keep their current policies. But in a twist on the legislative history, the Medicare agency has determined that their policies are not the actuarial equivalent of Medicare Part D. What that means is if at some point down the road, the people with Medigap policies decide to drop their coverage and take Medicare Part D instead, they will be subjected to a delayed enrollment penalty, even though they did have what they thought was adequate drug coverage all along. The delayed enrollment penalty was inserted into the law for the simple reason that Medicare Part D is voluntary. No one has to enroll. There is a monthly charge that is paid by the person who enrolls in addition to costs for the drugs, and many people may simply choose not to. When you have a voluntary program, it's necessary to get as many people into the pool as possible, or else people will simply wait until they have a genuine need. And this is comparable to people not buying fire insurance on their home until their home is in flame.
Now, that extra monthly fee, if they don't sign up immediately or by next May, is something that the people you mentioned before who have coverage through their former employer also have to worry about. They have to balance between, do I sign up for a new program or do I wait, possibly accept the penalty, and maybe my employer may get out of the drug coverage business?
That's a big concern. And as is so often the case with aspects of this program, there are very few generalities that can safely be made. For example, the Medicare statute provides a subsidy to current employers who are providing drug coverage for them to continue to do so. They actually are getting a payment from the federal government equal to about 28% of their costs, and that this payment is going to be tax-free to the employer. This was put in there near the end of the legislative process for the specific reason to encourage employers to maintain their coverage. Even then, a complicating factor is that employer coverage varies all over the map. Some policies have an annual limit of only $600. Others are much more generous. So some of the employer-provided health benefits that cover drugs are considered at least as good as Medicare, but others are not. That distinction means that if a person, for example, has an employer coverage that is as good as Medicare, but then the employer does drop the policy down the road, that enrollee can get into Medicare Part D without paying the penalty because they had equivalent coverage, or as the statute calls it, creditable coverage. A person who has employer coverage right now that is not actuarially equivalent, however, that person is faced with a particular dilemma. If they decide to get in Medicare Part D right now, they're going to be paying out of pocket. If, however, they stay with their current plan, which may cover their current drug needs, and that plan subsequently proves inadequate or it disappears, then that person can get into Medicare Part D but will be facing the same delayed enrollment penalty. People with employer-provided coverage are to receive a letter very shortly from the Medicare agency telling them whether their specific coverage is considered as good as Medicare Part D or not. And on that basis, then they will have several months to decide what they want to do. As you mentioned, the initial enrollment period lasts this year until May 15th. In the future, it will not be nearly that long, but part of the reason for the extended enrollment period is because a great many older people who have drug coverage are going to have to assess whether they want to keep what they have and basically take a chance that either their drug needs will not increase or that their employer will, in fact, maintain the coverage currently in force.
This is obviously a complicated plan. How do you assess what kinds of informational resources have been given to seniors about which path they ought to choose? Medicare has set up sites, websites, and sent out pamphlets. Employer policies have, I'm sure, been involved. But, how good, how useful has that information been?
Well, that's a real serious issue. You're quite right that Medicare has trained literally thousands of volunteers, as has the Senior Health Insurance Program, SHIP, in many of the states. There are a number of other groups that are more consumer-oriented that have also trained people because the decision precludes generalities. It literally has to be done one senior at a time. An expression I sometimes use is that people are going to need to take a laptop computer into their medicine cabinet. And part of that is because there is no one single plan. Illinois, for example, has some 29 different plans. I think in California it's over 40. And the plans will vary not just in the mechanics details like what is the deductible and what percentage do the people pay, but literally as to which drugs will be covered. Even two or three plans that purport to cover the exact same drug may differ in terms of dosage frequency or amount. So the senior literally has to compare what they are taking, how often, and in what quantity to see which plans are going to cover them and which ones are not. Now, the Medicare agency is just started a website, a calculator, which allows people, if they feel comfortable, to insert the name of all their prescription medications and their dosage amounts and frequency to try to determine which plan is the best for them. Keep in mind that many seniors do not feel technically capable of using the web. Oftentimes, however, they will have younger siblings or children or grandchildren even who can help them. Even overcoming that hurdle, however, many people feel a little uncomfortable putting such private information out on a website. It, of course, purports to be secure, but nevertheless, some people have some concerns about that. Overriding all of those issues is the concern, which is again in the law, that says that a Medicare drug plan that a person purchases has the right to discontinue or change the coverage of specific pharmaceuticals with 60 days advance warning. So, for example, a person could today find the plan that covers what they are taking and sign up for it, and say in the middle of March they get a notice that says that your particular drug is being dropped and if you want to continue to buy it, you will have to pay a higher copay or out of pocket or whatever the benefits you anticipated, they would not be forthcoming. The individual, however, is stuck in this particular plan until the end of the next calendar year, that is through the end of 2006, even though the plan has the flexibility to alter its so-called formulary, its list of covered drugs, literally with 2 months' notice.
What's been the have there been instances of fraud because of this? Is this a system that may be easy to be to for people to take advantage of?
So far, the program is simply too new to have much in the way of fraud reported. That is, for the most part, seniors have not parted with money and have not signed up. They're still trying to sort through the options. But anything this complex is going to have a certain degree of friction whereby people will offer to provide counseling for a certain fee where that's really not necessary because there are plenty of volunteer and free resources available. And there may be a number of even bogus plans with some 40 or so in many states and at least 25 in almost every state. The senior could very easily be enticed by a plan that sounds legitimate, that has many of the same names, and it's going to be very different from the standard Medicare where there's basically one Medicare. There is Medicare Part A that is run through the Social Security Administration, and that is a one-size-fits-all national program. There are no imitators. There are no duplicators. But this is a different model. This reflects a different philosophy. This is not one-size-fits-all. This is a whole range of options and choices, and many of those will be acceptable. And no doubt at some point there may be some bogus providers who are trying to capitalize on the general, you might say, surplus of information to capture some subscribers.
Is there discussion already about how Medicare Part D might be changed, how legislation may alter some of the things, alter some of the problems that we've seen as the enrollment period just begins?
It's an interesting point. There's been a fair amount of discussion since Hurricane Katrina with respect to Medicare prescription coverage, but only with respect to delaying the beginning of the program in order to save money for the federal government. That is, of course, a separate issue. It's certainly a significant fiscal consideration. This is an expensive program, and the focus has been maybe that the government can save a little money by delaying the beginning of this program. But there has been virtually no real discussion about changing the basic contours of the program. Keep in mind that this was enacted in the first part of December 2003. So there have been two full years whereby people could have proposed amendments and changes and tried to discuss how the program could be restructured, whether the deductible should be lowered or raised, whether the donut hole or coverage gap should be eliminated, and nothing has really happened. The only legislative activity is whether the whole thing should just be shelved temporarily to save the federal government some money. The idea of rethinking the basic design of the program has received very little attention, in part because this was a tough compromise. I don't know that anyone is particularly satisfied with the end result. There are a number of people in at least one political party who think that it should be redone on the model of Medicare Part A, where it's one plan fits all, the government is the provider, and people can get their prescription drugs from any pharmacy that is willing to be part of the program. The other reigning philosophy is that seniors want choices of plans, not choices of providers. This plan, as it was passed by Congress, passed by the narrowest of margins, some would say not entirely legitimately, in fact, that the vote was held open for 3 hours and there were all kinds of backroom maneuvers, which I think reflected the fact that this was a real compromise, that no one is particularly satisfied with it. And I think that's why in the intervening 2 years, we have not seen a plethora of alternative conceptions or plans to redo it, because no one really wants to reopen this can of worms. The only real effort to modify it has been when the date would start, and that has been with an exclusive focus on the financial impact on the federal government.
One other thing I wanted to ask, sort of as an aside, explain the donut hole. How did that all come to be, and who does that affect?
The donut hole is a peculiarity of this particular drug benefit plan. What its more technical name would be a gap in coverage. And how it works is that, without getting into too many numbers, after an individual has about $250 of expenses, the program pays for 75% of the cost up until the person's total drug costs are about $2,250 a year. Then the next $2,850, that hunk of cost is entirely borne by the individual enrollee. Thereafter, and now we're talking about a limit of $5,100, any further drug costs beyond that point, the government program or the Medicare program pays 95%. So it's an extremely generous coverage at the high end, this so-called catastrophic coverage. But for people whose annual drug costs would be between $2,250 a year and $5,100 a year, they are facing a gap of $2,850 where they bear the entire cost. There is really nothing comparable in any private drug plan in affecting any age group. And in fact, some of the Medicare alternatives that some private plans are covering have made a conscious effort to eliminate the donut hole. Now, how they've done that is with a higher deductible than the $250 and with a lower payment percentage. That is, they're not going to cover 75%. They're going to cover some lower number, more like 50%, but they will have that same coverage throughout the range of drug costs rather than having this relatively more generous coverage and then it just stopping. That was put in, again, no one designed it that way, no one wanted it, but there was an overwhelming feeling that people with really serious drug expenditures on the order of $5,000-$6,000 a year should have extensive coverage, and this plan does that. But that's a relatively small minority of seniors. To make this plan more popular, to make it politically saleable, to make it a benefit to the politicians who were putting it forward, it had to be more broadly applicable. Or to put it more bluntly, more people had to get a benefit from this than just the folks with very high-end prescription drug benefits. So they wanted a relatively low deductible and a fairly significant copayment percentage for the great bulk of seniors whose drug costs are less than $3,000 a year. So the twin decisions of covering most of the costs for people with very high drug expenses and providing a significant, visible, appreciated benefit for the great bulk of seniors meant that something had to give. And what had to give was basically the middle, where there is this gap of $2,850 in most plans where the enrollee pays the full cost.
Anything else to add that I may have left out?
It will remain to see how seniors adapt to this. Many people in nursing homes and people who are also eligible under state assistance programs are going to have some major coordination issues, not so much in terms of their costs, but in making sure that their particular medications are covered. It's going to be quite a learning process. And this is very different from the system that you find not only in other countries, but in most other health plans, even in this country, where the person or the provider, be it an HMO, a health maintenance organization, or some other plan, basically provides all of the drug costs within certain parameters. And you don't, and typically members of the HMO are not confronted with all of these separate opportunities and different combinations.
Well, thanks for your time.
Thank you.